Often most things are out of our control, but we just have to make the best of them. That has basically been the theme of my last week. I've been, of course, trying to figure out, well, what am I going to talk about today? Because, you know, I've been very, very, very busy. And an interesting experience in this busyness is that I haven't been able to overtly or very visibly be doing many kind of spiritual things. So I'm doing basically all of the things that I talk about because I am that very embodiment of a situation of somebody who's too busy and has no time to take care of the spiritual aspects of life. We're painting our bathroom and we had to move out of our bedroom because of that, and we have to use other bathrooms, and everything is a chaos from the living point of view. Yet at the same time, there's millions of things to do. There's all kinds of people coming to visit. And it's like when you live in Florida, all of a sudden you discover you have all these friends who like to come and visit you in the wintertime. And relatives. You get a phone call, "I'm coming tonight, is that okay?" And you go, "Of course, it's wonderful," except that your whole house is chaos. There's no way to get ready in time. You're not even living in your own room. So basically, it's an amazing time, and I realize that, you know, most people just don't have time to do a very sophisticated spiritual program. Anybody who's living a normal life, the life just consumes them. There's things to repair, there's things to buy, there's things to cook, there's things to clean, there's things to wash. There's full-time work, repair the car, the toilet overflows. Things break, things need to be changed. And then you wonder, how am I ever going to get all of this together? And I go before the deities and I say, "I'm really sorry. It's impossible. I have no time. I just can't. I'm stressed." And it was very interesting. One of my clocks, the one I looked at, was 20 minutes late today. So I had in my mind that I'm very late because I had to vacuum the whole house before this broadcast, do a laundry and feed the dog, feed the cat, and clean up the whole mess. And then I look at my clock and the clock said, "Hey, it's only 20 minutes to 10. I have some time that I can go and no, actually it was 20 minutes after 10. I have some time I can go meditate." So I went in the temple room and I sat down and I just let it all go, all the stress and all of the problem. And I just thank the deities for helping me just to understand more and just be peaceful. And then all of a sudden they said, "We think you'd better go now. It's later than you think." So then I look at another clock and it's 1 minute to 10. So it was like a cosmic trick to get me to sit in the temple room and relax. And I still had nothing to talk about. I still have no topic for today. And so then Didi said, "Well, why don't you just tell people why you have no topic?" And the why is I've been so busy living the life that I have forgotten about trying to figure out what to talk about life. Now, that's a very interesting situation, that when you are describing life, when you are talking about life, when you are visualizing life and expressing it, it's very different than when you are just living it. There has been a statement that's kind of like common in the English language. I don't know if it translates to Russian, but those who can do, those who can't teach. In other words, those who can do something, they do it. Those who can't do it, they teach it. It's a very rare combination of a person who's active in a particular field who also has the time and the inclination to teach it. And I find it very interesting about what I do on Saturday is that for sure it's not a teaching because I don't really feel like I'm teaching. I feel basically I'm just sharing with you my thoughts and feelings of the week before. But if I were to really share with you my thoughts and feelings of the week before, I would be sharing with you about this color and that kind of paint and this thing and that bookshelf and we're growing food here and all this stuff. It's like it would be not very interesting spiritually. So yesterday, as it was at its peak of madness, some friends came to visit. And we ended up talking about health and community. A lot of the things that we do are revolving around our physical health, revolving around our physical situations. Because a lot of the time we have this problem of not being able to properly get enough nutrients or have enough energy or do things we're supposed to do. And naturally we're growing older. It's not that growing older is for other people, it's also for ourselves. And because of that, we have to deal with the gradual deterioration of our system, which continuously needs to be maintained. So my whole week was basically about maintaining our house and maintaining the bodies in the house. Yet there is also the maintenance of the spirit. Now, it's interesting when I use the word spirit because in English anyway, I don't know how it translates to Russian or other languages, but when we talk about spirit, it can mean the spiritual being, or it can mean a spiritual entity, but it can also mean the energy with which I do things. Like sometimes when people do things in a very, very enthusiastic manner, we say that, oh, they are very spirited. Dealing with the spirit can be seen in a variety of ways. I mean, you can see it as developing your spirit, or you could see it as maintaining your contact with it, or you could see it as being enthusiastic with life. It's either developing your spiritual life or engaging in a meditative process by which you can experience it, or just being enthusiastic about life, being spirited. Just like a house. If you don't maintain it, in other words, fix the things that are wrong, it falls apart. As you grow and as the time changes, you must also improve it as technology changes, or as you should go into another kind of a system for heating or for electricity or so on. But it's also very important that you feel enthusiastic about living in your house. Because if you're not enthusiastic about living in your house, you won't really care about maintaining. You won't really care about upgrading and evolving it. Now, that's a very important point, and a point often which we neglect to think about in relationship to our own lives. I hear about it often. I get letters often. I talk to people who often have this very problem of perspective. It's a problem of understanding that unless you're enthusiastic, unless you have some spirit about your life, you'll not really find any reason to do anything with it. For example, I like our house, and therefore I like to make sure it stays in good shape, and when it needs to be evolved, it should be. I'm not thinking that, oh, in a couple of years or whatever, are we just going to get out of this place, or couldn't stand what happens at this place, go somewhere else, therefore I don't care about it now. So my thought process is, I like being in this place. It's important for me to be in this place, so I will take care of this place. Yet sometimes we find people make the mistake of, in their own lives, missing the importance of their personal enthusiasm. They miss the point of spirit, also meaning being spirited in life. If I compare my body with my house, with my feelings about my body as my motivation, and my enthusiasm is the same in both, the analogy is perfect. In other words, if I like my body, if I like what happens with my body, I will maintain my body. And if I don't maintain it, if I don't like it, that means I have no enthusiasm in life. Now, it doesn't mean you have to love your body. Ooh, it's so nice. It means you have to like the synergy between your spirit and the vehicle through which you express yourself. And when this synergy is existing, you'll have a reason to take care of both sides of the synergetic equation. You'll be careful to maintain the enthusiasm of your spirit, and you'll be careful to maintain that vehicle through which that enthusiasm of spirit is expressed. And again, there are two ways that's done, by maintenance and by evolution of it. Now, you could just say that I would be perfectly happy with simply maintaining the connection between my body and my soul and nothing more. I eat the bear. I'll just do whatever is minimally required and nothing more. Well, that concept could be very acceptable if you really defined the term enough. What is sufficient to maintain the body? Now, there have been many studies, and many people have personally experienced that eating less is actually going to extend the duration of your life. Almost all physical problems, somewhere down the line of history, can be rooted to improper digestion and assimilation. Now, we're not talking about accidental problems due to accidents. We're not talking to inherited problems and things like this. I know that in the Ayurvedic tradition, they say that all disease comes from ama, which means undigested food. I know a doctor in Germany who was telling me the story about some doctor in the turn of the 19th century, 1800s, 1900s, who was doing experiments with, had such a strong digestion, he once ate poison and it did not kill him because he could digest it. And most digestive problems come from overeating, which means that the pancreatic enzymes and all the other enzymes which are so important for digestion are overloaded. And the blood sugar goes out of balance. And therefore, one starts to absorb all of the toxins which are there instead of just passing them through. Especially nowadays when we're so surrounded by toxicity. Everywhere things are polluted. So from that point of view, not eating too much is a very sound principle. From another point of view, one doesn't need to go out and buy all kinds of processed foods, refined foods. Live foods that you can grow yourself are also very healthy. But then one also has to do something with this body. One can't just do nothing. Even the yogis would engage in yoga, which would move the body in such a way that it would maintain its flexibility, its health. So one has to do physical exercise. One has to make the brain work. You have to use the brain, because if you don't use the brain, it'll become very dull. And the thing about the brain is that there have also been studies which have shown that for old people who just really want to just slide into death because they have no enthusiasm, no spirit, they don't use their brain, so their brain becomes kind of dull. And those people who have a spirit for life and do things and are active with their brain remains clear. So let's say you're into spiritual things. You're a very deep spiritualist. Have you ever seen like these big, huge kind of Buddha kind of fellows or very big Brahmana pundits? They just sit in one place and they're just very big, huge. Because they're not doing any physical exercise. They're only doing mental exercise, so they become very fat. Well, this is a serious situation. And such a serious situation could be in any aspect of your life that you neglect. You can become flabby in the body by not using the body properly or not eating properly. You can become flabby in the brain by not being active in the brain. You can become flabby in the spirit by not being active in the spirit. But let's go back to that example of the house again. Unless you like living in that house, unless the experience of living in that house is something which has some meaning to you, you are not going to take the trouble to repair, to expand that house. So in a similar way, one has to have some spirit. Without that spirit in life, one will see no reason to do anything in life. Human beings have an amazing capacity to just do things because they are a habit. They eat because of habit. They do their daily chores because of a habit. Daily activities, chores, means like the works they do normally in the day, the list of things they do. So it's a continuous situation where the daily habit becomes the norm, that one is not really connected with it because one doesn't really care. It's just a habit. So human beings also can relate with each other out of habit like that, just simply because it's just, they're not into it. It's just something they do, and hello, how are you? I'm fine, is a perfect example of that. In fact, the society generally supports people who are not connected within their lives. What amazes me is that the synergy between the physical world and the world of energetic spirit is not required to function in this world. You can go through life saying good day, hello, goodbye, how are you, I'm fine, and it would not make any difference. You can go through life just going to work, earning some money, paying some bills, eating some food. It wouldn't make any difference whether you're connected or not. But it could make a difference if you were, for instance, getting sicker, or if you were getting poorer, or if you were having great human problems. But then you're in the situation of playing catch-up. You've got to fix the things that are going wrong. It's called reactive. You've got to react to things which are happening in your life. You have to react. That's all. You're not making it happen. You're just, things are happening at you and you have to fix it. Nobody is enthusiastic about life when they're playing fix-it man or fix-it woman. That's not the way you become enthusiastic. You become enthusiastic because you like doing what you're doing. Now, why would you like doing what you were doing? There has to be a reason for it. Now, it's a very interesting experience, I see, that most people see no reason to feel interested in their lives. They're so burdened by the effort it takes to live that the enthusiasm for life becomes suppressed. Now that, I see, is the key to physical well-being, mental well-being, spiritual well-being, emotional well-being. Why is it when one first goes into a new thing, a new spiritual thing where there seems to be so many interesting experiences, that one is so enlivened, but later on, after many years, it starts to reduce? Simple, because it's new, it's exciting, it's evolving, it's something that captures our spirit. But after a while, one gets acclimated to it, and it doesn't have the same spark. So the same problems come in that are there in any situation of life when we don't feel some enthusiasm. We don't feel spirited about what we are doing. It seems to me, seeing this pattern repeat in all aspects of life, that this spirit this enthusiasm of life is the key to everything. You can be a big time spiritualist, following every single principle there is, doing all kinds of things. But if you don't have that enthusiasm, it's not going to work. Or alternatively, the same situation might be there for one's physical health or other, or one's maintenance of one's house or one's education or the way one cares about others. So it all boils down, I feel, to this enthusiasm. Now, if somebody were to ask, how can we be enthusiastic? I can't answer that question because it doesn't have an answer. It's not something that somebody else can tell you. Your experiences do not fall into categories. You can't make a category of your experience and have principles which work and principles which don't work. The amazing thing about this is that experience and enthusiasm and all of these very, very significant aspects of our life defy categorization. When you're having an experience which is really, really exciting, which is really, really just capturing you in all ways, how do you describe it? How do you express to somebody else your experience? Generally, the best way to do it is to just walk in with your face just beaming and exploding with excitement. And then the people will say, wow, what were you just doing? How would you describe it? How would you philosophically categorize it? How would you organize it? None of these things would do justice to the experience. When you feel that experience, you become enthusiastic about it, that thing that created the experience. Because you've got an experience, that experience you like, you become enthusiastic because you want to repeat it. And then you become kind of a fanatic about it. Like, say, you're going to go skiing and you love the skiing experience and you get your best skis and you polish them or wax them or whatever you do. And it's just like you really get into it. This is the key, the one and only key to success in anything you do. Actually, there are many managerial principles. There may be many techniques. There may be many things you should do or you should say. But the most significant, the topmost technique or the topmost principle of all of this is to keep the people who work for you enthusiastic. If they're happy doing what they're doing, they'll do it well. If they're not happy doing what they're doing, they'll do it not well. And when a group of people are happy doing what they're doing, then what happens is that the others become interested in it. Others say, oh, this is a very good thing. I want to do it too. Because that happiness and that enthusiasm within a group attracts others to it. I mean, after all, if you had neighbors who were always miserable, would you want to go to their house and eat with them? And if they were happy and enthusiastic about life, you would want to be part of it. You wouldn't mind at all. You would say, hey, that's great. Now, our spiritual life, it's a nice concept. It's this idea of spiritual life. It's like things I do. And maybe even a place where I do them. But unless and until that enthusiasm is there, the place can just be a place. The things can just be things. This spirit with which we do things is the catalyst. It's the few drops that turn this coal-like existence into that diamond of brilliant beauty. Okay, Diamonds are made from pressure and coal and all that. I'm just trying to make an analogy. But the idea is very simple, that if we are aware of how powerful a motivating factor that enthusiasm is, we will be better prepared to deal with all of the other situations around us. And if we are aware of how our enthusiasm for life, how our enthusiasm for our bodies, or how our enthusiasm for our homes, or how our enthusiasm for our spirit becomes reduced when we just react, we see it different. We can see the effect of how reacting all the time, of being put upon all the time, of having pressure upon us all the time, reduces our enthusiasm. It smothers our enthusiasm. And yet, if we can see that acting in advance, it's called proactive, being ready to move into the future creates enthusiasm, we will be more capable of keeping ourselves enthusiastic. Now again, how do you do that? Well, I'll try to give some indication, but it's just really a very difficult thing to do. Because, after all, it's only us who can see relevance in our lives. Let's say I, for example, can understand things about my life. I can see the direction my life has gone, and I can project into the future a possible scenario. I look through the past, I look at my recent past, I see the flow of things, and I look into the future, and I project how it will be right up to the death. I have to look at that, and then I have to say, do I like that, or do I not like that? If I do not like that, I should change it. What is it that I want to place instead of this system of just inertia? It's been going that way, it'll continue to go that way. Where do I want it to be now? What would I like it to be? Usually at this point, most people freak out. It is such a cosmic revelation when you've seen how your life is rolling into something, and then you realize that, my God, I have to come up with an alternative situation. What would be the alternative situation? What could it possibly be? At this point, there you throw open the whole realm of infinite possibility. The mind starts doing flip-outs, somersaults. It flies all over the universe. You find no shelter because it could be anything. But it's actually not like that. It's not that it could be anything. There are a lot of restrictions about what it could be. So we have to then become realistic. It's not that you have the possibility to be anything you want. For example, if I want to be president of the United States, I don't have that possibility. Somebody may say, yes, you do. If you really want to, you can go out there and make it happen. I say that's ridiculous. First of all, there's no question on earth that a former Hare Krishna is ever going to be the president. Second of all, I have no qualification whatsoever, according to politics or according to the legal situation, to be president. And third of all, I wouldn't do it no matter how much money you paid me. So there are enormously restricted avenues that I can go down. So if I'm looking down those avenues and I'm seeing that which would be acceptable to me or not, then I can make some adjustments according to the possibilities that really do exist. Or we may even simply understand that the road we are moving down is actually the best one. And it's not the road we're moving down that's the problem. It's my way of seeing it. I've seen in my own life that my biggest problem is when I don't accept what's unfolding. I say, no, I don't like it that way. I want it this way. So I'm fighting with my life. It's a whole battle. And I don't accept it. And I don't want it. And I don't like it. But that makes everything impossible because I'm not changing it that way. And things are moving in a certain way. When I go with the flow and I adjust the flow, much better. It's like I'm out there on the ocean and I'm on my surfboard and I'm paddling out and the waves are coming and I'm going, get out of my way, you stupid wave. What are you doing here? Out, out. And when I turn the surfboard around and catch the wave and go with it, then I can turn to the left. I can turn to the right. I can go up and down. If I'm laying on the surfboard and I'm in the ocean, there is a fundamental fact I have to accept, which is the wave is bigger than me. I can fight the wave, sure, but what am I going to accomplish? And when I go with the wave, I can have fun. I can go somewhere. I can maneuver. And after a while, if I have any brain, I'll realize, well, wait a minute, that's the whole point of being out on the ocean on this surfboard with the wave. That's the whole point. So then I get into it, and I'm doing it here this way, that way, and I say, hey, this is fun. It's an experience. I am enthusiastic. So you can fight life, you can resist life, you can resist everything that is coming at you. You can do that. You can say, it's no, not for me. It's not going to happen to me. But the more you persist, the more you resist it, the more it persists and it resists you. It's like when, you know, you get two kids who are just up against each other and one goes, yeah, and the other goes, yeah, 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 yeah. But the point is, the more you resist, the more these things persist to push you, to drill you, to insist that you respect them. So we have to respect life. Yet we have to be enthusiastic. And therefore, the only method to do it is to ride the wave of life. This is also the principle which guides spiritual life. To ride the wave of whatever it is we are, wherever we are, however we are moving, and see it as our spiritual challenge. And whatever we have to move around, whatever we have to maneuver with, see that as that challenge which makes us feel enthusiastic because we're gradually meeting the challenge. And we're going to get out of our life what we were meant to get out of our life with the whole flow from all the way back through time, all the way as it moves forward. I have an interesting question here. This one is about my comments about power and force and when and how to use them in a better way, and is it needed to have power or force? I'm not sure in which way the word power is used in this particular respect, but I would like to answer it according to how I would accept it. If you take force as being like the force as in power, the force, like the, may the force be with you, that's one thing. If you take force to be like push and shove and like that, that's quite another. Force that is a force which makes you do something against your will, makes you do something when you don't really feel like doing it or fits a square peg in a round hole, is not very advantageous. That's kind of obvious. We don't even need to explain why. You know, all know why. But then there's another kind of force, like the force that comes with you, power, a power which is of a universal nature. This kind of power is very valuable because it's what causes all things everywhere to move, to work, to be manifested. So obviously power is required. It's not like you can live without power. Power has to be there. It's just an essential aspect of life. Power is what makes all things work. But the problem comes when power forces. When power forces, what happens is that you have a serious situation of conflict or resistance, because when you have to force something, that means the thing you are forcing doesn't want to cooperate. So that is a misuse of power. But when you have something that empowers, a power that gives you power, a power which integrates you within it, that's a very magnificent thing. So if you use your power to assist others or to help others or to integrate others in their development of power, then it's a very valuable thing. And that's the way basically God does it. That's the way the divine beings do it. That's the way the universe does it. The power is there to facilitate our development, our maintenance, our enthusiasm, our lives. So when power is used like that, power has enormous uplifting, nourishing qualities to it. But when power is used to press, to force, to make things happen in a way which is unnatural for the things, it becomes a suppressing factor. So power in and of itself is neither good nor bad. It's a question of how it's used. And when it's used in a nice way, then power has a very nice effect. When it's used in an improper way, power has a very damaging effect. And I think that answer is, although not maybe exactly what the questioner wished to get, was a general enough answer that all questions about that use of power can fit within it. I have here another question, which is very elaborate. I'll just get to the question because there's a huge commentary with the question. The question is about how can we imagine the unfolding of a future with an enthusiastic potential when we have a limited state? And the question was in relationship to, for instance, loving others or building muscles without really knowing what the muscles will be used for, or in other words, just expanding the potential without having to have a goal where it's going to move to. To answer this question, I think we have to distinguish between expanding a potential that needs to be developed and creating or organizing something. There are two different things. Because my potential, I already have. It's something that's already there. And it's from the past. It's something I have from the past. And it's something I can bring into the future even better. So it fits. So it's not really a limitation in that sense. But when we're trying to develop an organization or build a structure, for instance, just as a wild example, you see in your future to make a very great computer company. So let's say you're not a computer kind of person. You're not a technical kind of person. You're not even a managerial kind of a person. You don't have that potential, yet you have that desire. So if you have like a potential to play an instrument, or you have a potential to be an artist, you have the potential to be a cook, you have a potential to be a carpenter, these potentials can manifest. But if you don't have the potential, to create manifestation of it is very difficult, if not impossible. So what I would assume would be the answer to this question is that wherever there is a potential that's naturally existing, it would fit within your limitation. If there's no potential, it is the limitation. Because after all, when it's not within your it's not within your field of potential future, it's not that it's some kind of restriction upon you. It's just something that was not given or accepted in this lifetime. Now the questioner is asking me, what about morality, I think? What about developing morals? Can you develop a morality or morals if you don't have it? Or is it already part of what you are? Well, that's interesting. That would imply that there are people in this world born without morals. There are people completely devoid of morality. And there are people who are born with morality. I think we'd better define morality, because it's the key to understanding this situation. What is the morality that we're talking about? Let's take some basic moral principles, like you give me some. Write them down. You write me. List some moral principles. I want to know what you think before I start defining what the morality is. Misuse of power. Okay, that's one of them. Misuse of power. That is a very significant lack of morality. That can also fit in ethics. I don't mean to overly generalize, but I think that irresponsibility is another. I think that a lot of these qualities of in that particular format of ethic or morality are derived from childhood. Let's say that you had a particular kind of family situation when you were a child, whereby morality was defined in non-functioning ways. In other words, morality was get as much as you can for yourself, and that's the most moral thing to do. Let's say you were born in a family, if we take misuse of power, irresponsibility, inability to devote to relationships. In other words, this lack of care for others, this selfishness. If you boil it down, it comes down to selfishness. I think about me, I care about me, I don't care how what I do affects you as long as it's good for me. Now, I have heard that people say that most children are selfish. They are protective of their toys, they are protective of their space, of their rooms, of their things. They want to watch what they want to watch and do what they want to do, and they don't really care whether or not you want. Sharing is not necessarily important for them. Yet there are children who are quite opposite to that, who will go out of their way to share, who will go out of their way to care about others, who will be very sensitive about others. So you can't just boil down everything to childhood, to your family, to your surroundings. There are children who are born with different feelings of selflessness and care of others than others who are born with more selfishness and care for the self. I don't think that if a child is very sensitive and concerned about others, even if the parents are showing the example of and explaining why it's, or rationalizing why it's good to be selfish, that they will pick up those qualities. I don't think so. In other words, I don't believe that you're totally a product of your behavioral modifications that take place throughout your life. I know for me, it's very hard for me to be selfish. Even when I go out of my way to try, it's very hard for me because it's just not my nature. So my mother showed me my kindergarten, that's preschool, even before you start the elementary school, you're 5 years old. She showed me I was actually four at that time. She showed me my report card from the school, and the teacher said, Robert's always helping others with giving them some ideas or sharing his toys. And I was saying, geez, I was always like that. Can you actually teach somebody who is a selfish person to not be selfish? I'm not sure. But what you can do is help a selfish person understand why they're selfish. And then they themselves may make the transformation. So in that case, that limitation becomes an impetus for great growth. But how to encourage that is very difficult to say, because I don't see many programs out there to turn selfish people into selfless people. I just don't see it. Yet there may be, in some cases, some ways in which we can encourage selfish people to move forward. And a lot of times that depends on having them see how it's in their interest, playing on the selfishness, it's in your interest to treat others nicely so they will treat you nicely. So whereas a selfless person would naturally act that way, a selfish person who's modifying their behavior for their own sake would immediately have a reaction of selfishness, but then adjust it for their own sake to get something good for themselves. So that modification of behavior would work for the benefit of society, even though maybe the motivation with which it's taking place is a little bit twisted. It's complex when you talk about morality like that, like misuse of power. Well, misuse of power means I got power, you don't. I'm going to do something with my power that's for my benefit, not for yours. That's selfishness. Being irresponsible, which means that one has commitments, one has responsibilities that one should take care of, but one doesn't because one just doesn't care. One doesn't care about those responsibilities. One only cares about what makes one feel good. That is selfishness. I suppose the inability to devote to relationships is a kind of irresponsibility in one sense, yet at the same time it might be part of one's nature. But none of this has anything to do with our potential. Because even if you are a very selfish person, you still have potential. It's just how you manifest it that becomes selfless or selfish. And I suppose you could, envision your future either as a one in which you are alone or you are with others. That's what modifies children's behavior. If they're selfish all the time, they take all the toys, they don't allow anybody to interact with them, gradually none of the children want to be with them, and they're left alone, they don't like it, so they change their behavior. So if your future is limited by your selfishness, and you don't like the loneliness of that selfishness, then you have to modify your behavior to accommodate others, which may mean doing selfless things.